Today is Wednesday, December 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. As COVID cases surge elsewhere around the world, South America is now the most vaccinated place in the world.
Despite the fact that President Jair Bolsonaro is one of the most vocal leaders against the vaccine in Brazil, the Brazilian population is already used to many vaccination campaigns.
Lebanon's president lashes out at his country's cabinet for not meeting in months as the country's economic crisis deepens.
The ministers are absent, all the Christian ministers are absent, all the Sunni are absent. Whether a cabinet meeting can be held and whether it will be representing the nature of the system.
And rights groups in Kenya pressure authorities to resettle thousands of squatters left homeless just before the holidays, thanks to a new freeway. We'll have these stories and more next. The World Health Organization says the number of COVID cases recorded worldwide increased by 11% last week compared with the previous week. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
There were nearly 5 million newly reported COVID cases around the world last week, with Europe accounting for more than half. The U.S. saw more than a million cases. That's a 34% increase from the previous week's report. But the WHO says deaths worldwide were down 4% to under 45,000. The health agency also says the overall risk related to the new Omicron variant remains very high, but that based on early data, there's a reduced risk of hospitalization. I'm Julie Walker.
The French government is moving forward with plans to step up the pressure on unvaccinated people to get the shot. At a parliamentary hearing on Wednesday, the health minister is defending a government plan to allow only vaccinated people to enjoy continued access to restaurants, cinemas, theaters, sports arenas, and other public places. It's part of a government strategy to use vaccinations rather than a new lockdown to curb the impact of the Omicron variant. France reported nearly 180,000 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday. South America, once ground zero in the global fight against COVID-19, is now the most vaccinated region in the world, with 63.3% of the population fully inoculated, according to the Our World in Data Project, which collects official numbers from governments worldwide. Gillian Kitchener of Reuters has this report.
For much of 2020 and early 2021, South America was ground zero in the global fight against COVID-19. Back then, oxygen ran low in Peru. Gravediggers worked through the night in Sao Paulo. But now, South America is the most COVID-vaccinated region in the world, according to government data collected from the Our World in Data Project. Over 63% of South America's population is now fully inoculated, a higher percentage than in Europe. And while last year Brazil saw its COVID-19 death toll rise to the second highest in the world after the United States, the current high rate of vaccinations has caused infection and death rates to plummet. Infectious disease expert Roberto Medrano.
Despite the fact that President Jair Bolsonaro is one of the most vocal leaders against the vaccine in Brazil, the Brazilian population is already used to many vaccination campaigns and is being massively vaccinated.
Past vaccination campaigns waged a war against smallpox, meningitis, polio, and measles, and built public trust. Experts say the region's effective public health messaging has also been key. But vaccination rates among children vary dramatically in South America, with authorities in some countries relatively slow to approve shots for minors. And experts say the region is far from out of the woods just yet, as the highly transmissible Omicron variant, which may be more adept at dodging the immunity generated by previous COVID-19 infections, spreads across the globe.
That was Gillian Kitchener reporting for Reuters. A military tribunal in Cameroon this week sentenced 47 opposition party members to between 1 and 7 years in prison for rebellion and attempted insurrection. Police arrested the Cameroon Renaissance Movement supporters in September 2020 while they were planning protests against the 40-year rule of President Paul Biya. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
More than 20 supporters of the opposition Cameroon Renaissance Movement, MRC, on Wednesday morning stood in front of MRC leader Maurice Kamto's house. They told a reporter they are waiting to hear from Kamto after a Yaoundé military tribunal this week sentenced 47 of his supporters to up to 7 years in jail. The tribunal on Monday and Tuesday sentenced the 47 opposition party members to between 1 and 7 years in jail for attempted insurrection. The MRC party's spokesperson, treasurer, coordinator, and president of the women's wing were among those given seven-year terms. 41-year-old bestseller Emmanuel Kwenye was among those condemning the prison terms.
Si les gens ont marché pour exprimer leur mécontentement, c'est pas normal qu'on les arrête et on les met.
He says it is very wrong and abnormal for authorities who claim they are democratic to order the arrest and sentencing of people who simply expressed their democratic opinions. Kwanye says they are expecting Maurice Kamto, head of the MRC party, to give directives on what should be done to press for the release of the jailed opposition supporters. Cameroonian police arrested the opposition members in September 2020 while they were planning protests against President Paul Biya's long stay in power. Biya has ruled Cameroon for 4 decades, making him Africa's second longest ruling leader. Kamto claims he won the October 2018 presidential election in Cameroon and that Biya stole his victory. More than 500 civilians who protested the crackdown also were arrested. The MRC says more than 120 are still being held in prisons across Cameroon. When contacted by VOA, MRC officials refused to comment on this week's sentencing of their members. President of the opposition United Socialist Democratic Party, USDP Prince Ekoso, witnessed the military tribunal's sentencing. Ekoso says the ruling shows that Biya will crush opponents to maintain his grip on power.
It is so disturbing that in Cameroon, laws are made to suit the caprices of individuals to carry out intimidation and arbitrary arrest and sentencing of individuals. Laws are supposed to be made to protect the individuals, to protect the citizens, and to help those citizens to emancipate.
The USDP and MRC have been pressing for a change in Cameroon's electoral code, which the opposition parties say favors President Biya. MRC leader Kamto said they plan to mobilize supporters to protest peacefully for electoral reforms in Cameroon from January 9. Cameroon is hosting the month-long Africa Football Cup of Nations, the continent's premier soccer tournament, from January 9. Cameroon's Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says authorities will not allow protests to release jailed opposition leaders or change the electoral code.
Nous n'allons tolérer aucun désordre. Les auteurs, comme ceux qui...
Ngi says Cameroon will not tolerate the disorder. The government is aware MRC supporters and their leader Maurice Kamto are planning. He says any MRC supporters and leaders who attempt to violate Cameroonians' laws will be arrested and face charges in court. Rights group Amnesty International accuses the Biya government of relentless repression of opposition members. In January 2019, authorities detained Kamto and several hundred of his supporters for insisting that Biya stole the 2018 presidential election. International pressure led Biya to pardon Kamto, but only after he had spent 9 months in prison. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Rights groups in Kenya are pushing authorities to resettle tens of thousands of squatters evicted just ahead of the holidays to make way for an expressway. Brenda Molina reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan Lucy Wangare, in her 40s, cleans a makeshift tent that has provided her family flimsy shelter since October when Nairobi city authorities evicted them from their home of almost 2 decades. She, her husband, and her sister spend the holiday season living in the tent, enduring cold and wet nights. City authorities evicted more than 40,000 squatters like Wangari from Mukuru Kwajenga slum and razed their homes to make way for construction of the Nairobi Expressway. What is left of the Mukuru slum looks like a wasteland, with scores of makeshift tents forming a small island. Authorities gave them just days' notice to vacate their homes, says Wangari. If you look at where I sleep, she says, you'd think I wasn't a Kenyan citizen. You'd think I was a refugee. Wangari says they used to have property and houses, but right now they've been left destitute. She blames Kenya's government. The $500 million elevated expressway aims to ease Nairobi's notorious traffic by connecting the main international airport to the city center and the wealthy suburbs. The Chinese state-owned China Road and Bridge Corporation is building and financing the expressway, which should be working in 2022 and will collect the tolls for nearly three decades. Despite critics calling it a road for the rich, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta defended the project while taking a tour of it the day before Christmas.
The difference that is being occasioned by the road building, by the drainage being put in, by the sewage being put in, I do believe that within another 2 years, Nairobi will be a truly 21st century city, catering for its population in a positive manner and in a manner befitting our people.
But Kenyan right activists fault the government for not striking a balance between the need for infrastructure and human dignity for those evicted. 25-year-old Anami Daudi is with the Mukuru Community Justice Center.
It's so traumatizing. People are having mental issues here. We have other special challenges here. They should get like special attention. But you find out that even the facilities that we have around, they can't maybe even accommodate or maybe to create that space to provide such services.
The single squatters left homeless like 38-year-old Pauline Gedoni struggle with security fears. It's very dangerous to spend the night here, she says, especially for us women. Gadone says the men can defend themselves if attacked, but she can't fight anybody. If someone attacks me and steals my property, tells me to leave, she says, I will have no choice but to obey them. City authorities' promises to compensate and help resettle the evicted families have yet to come true. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Dam. Lebanon's president expressed outrage this week that the country's cabinet has not met for over 2 months because Hezbollah politicians are demanding that Judge Tariq Bitar be removed from the Beirut port blast case before they agree to a cabinet meeting. The government standoff comes as the nation suffers from a worsening economic crisis, including a delay in negotiations with the International Monetary Fund. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshinawi discussed the veto power of Hezbollah in Lebanese politics with Joe Macaron, a Lebanese-American political analyst.
First, the nature of the sectarian system in Lebanon, especially in the last two decades, when ministers from a certain sect boycott the cabinet meeting, a lot of debates about whether it's constitutional to be held or not. And this has been part of the governance crisis in the past two decades. If all the Shiite ministers are absent, or the Christian ministers are absent, or the Sunni are absent, whether a cabinet meeting can be held and whether it will be representing the nature of the system. And this is one of those crises. Definitely the arms of Hezbollah, the political and military weight they have in Lebanon, gives more significance to this veto. So this is why we had Michel Aoun disrupt the governments before. We had many instances where the cabinet was prevented from meeting. But this shows that Hezbollah is standing with its allies, and it reflects the difficult relation between Hezbollah and the President Aoun. The alliance is shaky now going into the parliamentary election, and it shows the weakness of Mikati, the new prime minister, who's unable to save his government because he also have allies with the parliament speaker, Berri, who's close to Hezbollah. So it reflects, I think, the complicated and difficult, dysfunctional Lebanese system now, and it shows that any party, especially the traditional one with significant weight, can disrupt the country and the government without any repercussion, especially during an economic crisis.
The Lebanese president referred to a number of issues preventing the country's government from operating as the nation suffers from a worsening economic crisis, including a delay in negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the blockage of the cabinet from meeting. What is the way out? First, from the political stagnation. Second, from the devastating economy in Lebanon.
To put it simply, we shouldn't expect any breakthrough before the presidential elections. The country now is basically in those calculations now. I don't expect anything on the IMF talks. The government is not meeting to pass a budget. There's still big divide on the numbers that are giving to the IMF. So we shouldn't expect any major breakthrough. On economic collapse is continuing gradually, and there's no clear government plan on how to get out of this. And on the political stagnation also. This government is very weak, as expected. It's unable to give the basic services or basic governance because of the political stalemate due to the foreign intervention and due also to the nature of the political class, the corrupt level that they have. So I don't see a way out before we get to the election. First, the parliamentarian, if it was held on time, and second, the presidential. We should expect delays on this even. So I think everybody is in this mode, and the U.S. and Iran are not willing at this point to concede this political crisis to have a real breakthrough between the two. And the complicated aspects also of the Lebanese political system and the nature of the oligarchic system. So yeah, I don't see any major breakthrough before the presidential election next year.
That was Lebanese-American Joe Macron. He was speaking with my colleague Mohammed Elshinawi. Syrian news reports say the government accuses Israel of a rocket attack that touched off a huge fire in the port area early Tuesday, damaging a large number of shipping containers. Arab media claim Israel destroyed a number of containers transporting Iranian weapons. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Syrian TV showed fire crews trying to extinguish a massive blaze early Tuesday in the port region of the coastal city of Latakia after a rocket or missile barrage hit a shipping container depot. Syria accused Israel of the attack. Israel did not immediately confirm responsibility. Another attack on the same Syrian port facility on December 7 reportedly targeted an Iranian missile shipment, according to Israeli TV. Israel has reportedly struck targets inside Syria at least 31 times during the past year, according to Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV. Syrian military officials in the region of Latakia denied that any weapons were struck in Tuesday's rocket attack. Colonel Jalal Dawood, an officer in charge of the area, told state TV the target was mainly economic. He says the rocket strike is part of an ongoing series of attacks, and it is a blow to the economy and the well-being of the Syrian people. He claims the containers that were hit held industrial goods and foodstuffs. Rami Abdulrahman, who heads the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, told Arab media that some of the shipping containers destroyed in the attack were filled with weapons, although it was not clear what type. He also claims that Russia, which has a major airbase 15 kilometers north of Latakia, refused to allow its S-300 air defense systems to intercept rockets used in the attack. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that Russia is in tacit agreement with attacks on the alleged Iranian arms shipments. He says that Israel's Channel 10 TV reported the December 7 attack on Latakia was aimed at a container carrying Iranian cruise missiles that had just arrived at the port, hitting it immediately, while Tuesday's attack most likely hit another container with a similar arms shipment. He adds there is a major dispute between Iran and Russia over the use of Latakia for arms shipments. Abu Diab went on to say that a number of other suspicious explosions took place Tuesday, although it is not clear who was behind them. One explosion reportedly took place at a Palestinian refugee camp near Homs, while a second reportedly struck an arms depot in the Damascus suburb of Douma. Al Arabiya TV showed amateur video of an explosion in the pro-Iranian Hezbollah stronghold of Nabishit in Lebanon's eastern Bekaa Valley. Hezbollah claimed the blast was caused by a rocket that accidentally detonated. Former Syrian Army Colonel Ahmed Rahal told Arabiya TV the Bu Kamel-Syrian border crossing with Iraq is becoming a major passageway for incoming Iranian weapons, while Latakia is becoming a key gateway for Iranian weapons arriving by sea. He asserted the amount of damage to the port of Latakia Tuesday shows the alleged weapon shipment must have been pretty large. Fires burned out of control in Latakia's port area for nearly 8 hours before being extinguished. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Indian government on Monday refused to renew a permission that is vital for Mother Teresa's missionaries of charity to be able to secure foreign funds. Reuters correspondent Flora Bradley Watson reports.
The Indian government has blocked Mother Teresa's charity from receiving funds from abroad. The move comes amid rising intolerance towards religious minorities in the country. Founded in 1950, Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity supports thousands of nuns around the world who run hospices, schools, leper colonies, and homes for abandoned children. On Saturday, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government refused to renew the charity's license under the Foreign Contribution Regulation Act. The Home Ministry said in a statement that while considering the application, it had noticed some, quote, adverse inputs. The charity has also been accused by hardline Hindu groups of leading religious conversion programs. The MOC has rejected those allegations, and local residents of Kolkata said on Tuesday they had seen no evidence of it.
I would request all our government officials in the central government to please come outside Mother House every morning at 6 o'clock and see the line of homeless poor people stretching for more than 1 mile who are given a free meal. Not one of those people is a Christian, and not one of those people are asked to become Christians.
Since Modi came to power in 2014, right-wing Hindu groups have consolidated their position across states. They have launched attacks on minority groups, claiming they are trying to prevent religious conversions. Now, several states have passed or are considering anti-conversion laws that challenge the right to freedom of belief in the country.
That was Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. Indonesia is lifting its ban on Boeing's 737 MAX aircraft 3 years after one of the planes crashed shortly after takeoff, killing all 189 people on board. The Transportation Ministry said Wednesday that the aircraft will be allowed to fly to Indonesia, but only after airlines carry out airworthiness directives. The ministry also will conduct inspections before letting the planes operate in the country. National Security Police in Hong Kong raided another pro-democracy media outlet and arrested several people with ties to the publication. After the raid, Stand News announced it would immediately cease publication and dismiss all employees. Among those arrested are Hong Kong pop star Denise Ho, a former Stand News board member. A government notice said the raid and arrest were a result of a conspiracy to publish seditious publications. The incident comes at the end of a difficult year for press freedoms in Hong Kong, where a controversial national security law is now in place. Israel's defense minister has approved several measures aimed at improving ties with the Palestinians following a rare meeting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Israel. The Office of Defense Minister Benny Gantz said Wednesday that he approved confidence-building measures. Those measures include the transfer of tax payments to the Palestinian Authority and the authorization of hundreds of permits for Palestinian merchants and VIPs and residency status for thousands of Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. A Bosnian war crimes prosecutor has indicted 9 Bosnian Serbs for the killing of about 100 Muslim Bosniaks, including 7 entire families, early in the war between 1992 and 1995. The indictments announced on Wednesday come 26 years after the end of the war between Orthodox Serbs, Catholic Croats, and Muslim Bosniaks. Some 100,000 people died in that conflict. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a pleasant evening.